Boom.
All right. So it was going to be the four amigos. Hugh had a last minute flight. So it's going to be Mason, Mike Amato, and me. What up?
Hello, Christopher.
Do you have another octopus fun fact? If not, that's okay. We
Haven't
don't.
really thought about them in a while. I did go to Italy this summer and I ate I had some squid ink dish where it was like a black squid ink sauce, and it was cuttlefish were served within the dish, and it felt wrong. Like I didn't want it. I ordered it like very willingly. Because I was like, this is the item on the menu I want to eat in Venice, because it seemed very like unique. But I felt bad because when I read the book about I think it's called Other Minds, I was like, cuttlefish are really cool. They're like this prehistoric kind of creature. They seem kind of fun. And I feel bad eating like octopus or cuttlefish. If I was like, I'll try to avoid that in the future, but I obviously don't. It
Was it
was
good?
delicious.
Thanks.
Yeah. Well, it was a little weird. It was they served like a black gloop on the dish. It looked really unappetizing. Everyone in the restaurant turned their head and looked. And it was like I was like that guy ordering like the fajitas, the chicken. It was really salty. But it was great. It was like I don't think I'll ever have a dish like that ever again. But the cuttlefish, they were tasty, but I felt bad.
Wild.
Yeah.
I sent Mason this video this morning. JP Mercia, I don't know if he interned at y'all's
He
clinic.
did. He did his
Yeah.
rotation at the at our Medford clinic.
So he sent me a video this morning. He just got into an Airbnb, and the Airbnb is octopus themed. The pillow is an octopus. The whole wall is a giant tentacle. And I was like, this seems like my worst nightmare. This doesn't even look like an enjoyable Airbnb, but
Yeah, so he's staying with me actually. That's our guest room, but whatever, Chris.
yeah. Okay, so Mike, what do you call it at the clinic? Who termed it below the knee? What are y'all calling it right now?
Well, one of my students from USC, Aaron, if he's listening to this podcast, he coined it the lower quarter of the lower quarter. It was just funny because I just think like at the time I was learning a lot about the calf muscle complex and interaction with the Achilles, and we were just diving into it at that point. But he was just joking about how there's like a lot of courses about the lower quarter. So he was like, we should have a course called the lower quarter of the lower quarter.
And I love that name. And I think that's what I'm going to name this pod. But essentially, I
Yeah.
know we'll initially talk about calf strains, but I'm open to talking about anything lower quarter of the lower quarter related. So let's start with calf strains. And I'll let you kind of orient the conversation where you want to go with it. But then I think also differentials, separating gastroc versus soleus, and then what other potentials could occur around that region they would want to rule out. We can start there.
Yeah, let's start there. So I think initially my interest in looking into like calf performance and its role in like rehab and functional tasks and sport performance would be at the Achilles. But I would you might have been a student at the time with me when that episode came out on the physical performance show when they had a podcast about calf strains. And I've seen a handful of them. I wouldn't say it's like the most popular strain that maybe comes into the clinic. And maybe that's just a case of like, underreporting or like under referring. But at this point now, I've had a couple over the last couple of years, and they're all interesting and different. And I think that podcast episode with the researchers that we're referring to in the papers that we read just has some interesting takes that I just hadn't heard of, whether it was differential, whether it was like treatment, whether it was like kind of return to play criteria. And I've seen it kind of play out in some, case studies here. I think last time we spoke about this, we had done a journal club when you used to do like those journal clubs. And I think that week I had done the journal club. And then the next week I had a patient who strained their hamstring and their soleus like at the same time playing softball. And it was like really fresh. And I was like, was able to put it into like action. But that's kind of like where all that kind of interest started. But I guess like the main crux of the conversation that interested me was the difference between a soleus strain and a gastroc strain. So I don't know if we want to kind of like dive into that first.
Yeah, I last month created one of the resource guides for CalU on calf strains, and it was so interesting reading kind of the heuristics of when you see a calf strain just based off of the task, what's more likely, a soleus strain or a gastroc. Mm-hmm. So maybe we can go into like what are initial things to consider subjectively when you're asking on eval, if you don't know which one, how would you kind of start funneling or directing your thought process?
Yeah, I think the easy thing would be the probably one, the strain that would be more familiar to people from like a history, mechanism, presentation would be a gastroc strain. Like I think when everyone thinks of a strain, they think of like I pulled my hamstring kind of moment where it's like a instantaneous like pull, pop, like I was doing something explosive, whether it was like sprinting, jumping, decelerating. And I think and that could be the nature of like the hamstring also being a two joint muscle and the gastroc being a two joint muscle, but that's like your typical gastroc strain. I think it sounds like every muscle strain that you've probably heard of, where you get like that, you know, quick step, snap, pop, and something happens, you know, like you're immediately aware. And I think they were referencing the like the medial gastroc head being like more common as like the strain.
Yeah, I think that's what I remember reading as well.
Yeah. So I don't know particularly why. It could be something about the muscle architecture. And then you may see like a visible defect, you know, like the bruising, kind of like the classic stuff. I think what would maybe throw people for a loop is the soleus strain being just a totally different kind of mechanism. It seems to be more progressive and almost gradual onset. There may not be a singular mechanism, like a point in time that someone can point to. They may be aware of it more so like after activity and trying to like almost restart activity or re-engage in like a similar activity like the next day. And it seems like more diffuse, like you can't like point to a spot. There's not like a, you know, a palpable defect as much. And it seems that the more continuous steady nature of activity is the mechanism rather than like a, again, like an explosive singular moment. So I think a lot of the papers point to like steady state running being like a big mechanism, whether it's like track and field, cross country, or even just like a steady state running of between like during a football match or rugby match.
So when you, let's say you've kind of figured out if it's gastroc or soleus, how, if any, would the rehab process look differently versus look similarly?
Yeah. And I just finished reading that expert opinion paper, which I think you'll probably reference or put in the show notes, because there really isn't a lot of research on it, right? Like we've wrangled up a few papers and one of them was like, you know, here are the risk factors and here's the return to play kind of stats. But there really isn't like a, you know, a large amount of articles produced on this. I think even like when I actually did an in-service last week, it was like a repeat of like journal club presentation that we do. And you just PubMed like calf strains and then you PubMed hamstring strains. Like the results are like dramatically different. There might be like tenfold like hamstring results that come up. I don't know if you were digging around again, but isn't
the occurrence still so high? Like,
yeah, so that's the tricky part. I don't get that. Like, I think, I don't know again if they're getting like underreported. But it seems like, according to the literature, that it seems like there's a high occurrence of it, especially in these sports, like the ones that we're talking about. Like, at least a lot of the research is coming out of Australia, so it's like a lot of soccer and rugby kind of stats. But you know, in other countries, like those types of sports are still pretty popular. Soccer is, you know, global. But you know, they point to a lot of the rehab being, again, dependent on kind of like the function of the muscle in a way. So I think you know, if you want to backtrack, I think the soleus is an interesting muscle because it kind of does everything. And I think one of the experts in that paper was just talking about, like, we just cover it all. Like, if we're like have some doubt about what their limitations are and what the type of strain it is and how severe it is, like we try to cover the whole spectrum, whether it's like, you know, peak muscle strength, you know, plyometric repeatability, endurance, like they kind of just try to cover the gamut. So I think if it's a soleus strain, you're wanting to not only think about like that high explosive activity, but that like almost like strength endurance, like their ability to be able to do 25 calf raises and their ability to, they're even like talking about like using stair training as part of their like rehab, where it's like, can they just like climb 5 flights of stairs because you're getting like that repeated like tibial progression and you're using the calf in like a similar like uphill kind of way. One thing that I thought was interesting that differs from like a soleus strain versus maybe like a hamstring strain or a gastroc strain is that they avoid like a lot of slow jogging early in the rehab process. So it's like when you have someone who strains their hamstring or another like the biarticular like gastroc, they may be able to get away with some slow jogging because it doesn't require that muscle group as much. And so like you can get some basic conditioning in. Whereas like the soleus its main role is kind of being like the powerhouse for slow, steady state running. So if you introduce that too early, it may prolong the rehab process because it's too stressful for it. Whereas they may rely more on like kind of, I think they're talking about like 80 meter, kind of like 5 to 7 meters per second running. So like a little faster, where like you're getting more hip and more knee kind of contribution to the running, and not doing such high volume and more like steady state kind of stuff. Cause it seems to prolong the soleus rehab, which can be tricky. Cause if your athlete is a runner, like is a like cross country runner or is a track athlete, like that is the sport. So it seems like prolonging the return to running is beneficial for the rehab process, which I don't think is something that maybe people think about, like the slow nature of it being like more stressful than like the faster running.
When you're doing an eval and it's a calf strain or any, if you're trying to get like some type of plantar flexion type of peak testing or endurance-based testing, what objective tests have you all set up in the clinic?
I think the basics hold pretty well. Like, I think like that's where like the ankle plantar flexion MMT is like pretty good. You know, like can they do single leg calf raises from the floor, you know, continuously with the 1 second kind of tempo for at least 25 reps. And there's other age related norms. You know, I think so if they're younger, I think some of those norms are like up to 30 reps continuously. So I think that's easy and you don't need anything. You just need like a metronome or something to keep it pretty steady, and making sure that they go to the same height each rep. So I think covering your basics first is like really important. And
yeah, so
papers point to that too. Like they talk about like doing that before they go anywhere else.
We were trying to standardize that in our clinic with like, how do we within clinicians create a reliable testing setup for that, you know, for the calf raise. How do y'all, like we've been doing both hands on the wall, kind of in like an A-frame position where the other knee is at like 90, and then we'll have the metronome, they'll pause at the bottom, they'll come back up. I think we're at the 1 second, maybe mm-hmm. we're at 2 seconds. Is that how y'all are doing it?
I stole this too from, my student Aaron. He had people just kind of scoop their hand underneath like a table.
Yeah.
So you get the balance, but you can't push up if your hands are underneath, right? So it's like instead of having your hands on top for balance, which obviously is some influence, just underhand. That seems to work well. And then yeah, the metronome. I'll use like the one second kind of, and just kind of keep that rhythm. I think the hard part would be height. I know Chris Johnson has an app, I think called like the calf raise, app. And it uses like a camera, so you can I think you can see if the height decreases, and then you can just call the test once they can't reach full plantar function.
And then if they start creating this kind of like knee bend kind of quad helping you get up strategy, or like,
yeah,
are you just calling it there?
Yeah, same. This is always tough too, because like Scott Morrison talks about this a lot too, right? Yeah, like there's a learning curve to testing, right? So you can see improvement in testing if they learn it. So I think, you know, giving them a trial and retesting it on their second visit is important, because like, you know, they may not have known that, and then you just need to explain things well, right? So yeah, straight knee, no forward movement, essentially trying to keep it vertical as possible. So I think that's tough, because you just see a lot of half-assed MMT testing. You know, it should be simple, right? That's something we learned in school. It should be like, you know, can you MMT? And like, you can see a lot of like, yeah, just different test positions, different instructions, different rules. I mean, you know, we've done the blood pressure thing where it's like, you know, you see such a wide variety in the way people test blood pressure. And that should be kind of as simple. That's not like a, you know, it's not like a psychometric test.
So, what about any soleus setup you all figured out? Finagle?
I'm working on it. I have an idea, and it's very similar to what Scott Morrison's doing with the Tindec. Essentially, the way you can do the best soleus test would be able to get somebody in like 100 degrees of knee flexion and getting them to like at least 10, maybe 20 degrees of dorsiflexion, and having it pretty rigid, you know, not having a lot of slack. So when they pushed up into whatever your dynamometer is, that they're not like calf raising and going to 0 degrees or even beyond, because then you're just losing peak torque. But some of the research I think shows like 20 degrees of dorsiflexion being peak torque, which is important, because I think a lot of the studies are talking about like, you know, like in rugby, like being in the scrum is like hard for them, because they're like in a lot of dorsiflexion, a lot of tibial progression. And then like the, you know, when you're landing from a running stride, there's tibial progression going on. So testing in that position is tough in the clinic. We have the handheld dynamometer, which we can like kind of prop their foot on like a 25 pound plate and push up into the belt. But I'm trying to rig it up so that the Tindec is underneath the foot, and that the line of pull is like through their medial malleolus. Only problem is, people should be aware of this, is like some of the research suggests that peak torque or peak the pounds of force could be up to like 2 times body weight. You need a device that can like handle that on one leg too. So it's a lot. Like you should, if you're testing two legs at the same time, which I wouldn't know how you would do that, but you could be creating like a really large amount of force that would probably break any device that you have. But Tindec just came out with a 300 kilogram version of their device. So that should be plenty. I think if anyone's pushing, you know, 660 on one leg, then I don't know, they're probably not in your clinic.
Discharged forever. Yeah, I tried creating a setup in our clinic early on, because I had so much time when I was building up my caseload, and I was like, this is such a fucking hassle. Because I think I sent both of y'all the picture where I was like on a tall pile of blocks and a short plyo, then I rigged it up on a rogue rack. It was either the Tindec or the handheld, and then I got like a gait belt to wrap around the thigh. And I'm like, each patient, the box height is going to vary, and trying to create that like similar dorsiflexion position without, it's tough.
It is tough. And I think the expert opinion paper, none of them were doing that for like their return to sport criteria. So I think you can do it without testing isometric soleus strength. It's nice. If you had a quick and easy option to do it, it would do you really well, I think. But you know, some of that research I'm grabbing is from like Achilles tendinopathy, you know, like when they tested the plantar flexion strength. And so, you know, that's something I'll try to do for sure with someone who has tendinopathy, because at least I have a little more groundedness in that. When it comes to like muscle strain, like I do like isometric testing to just give me some numbers, because for hamstring, I'll do it all the time because that's easier. I could just grab the handheld and have them flex into me. But if you can't do it at your clinic, I think like you have to make sure the MMT is good. And then their performance on their strength progression is going to be important. And they talk about in an expert opinion paper about, you know, starting with the body weight and being able to move to a Smith machine and doing it for like, you know, 6 to 8 reps with a, I'm assuming they're doing like, you know, appropriate RPE. So then you're like inferring that their like load tolerance and their strength is improving because they're essentially just like kind of climbing that classic, you know, periodization model where it's like working on endurance and you're working on strength and you're working on power. So again, you could always get like a left versus right comparison with that. You know, what's their 5RM?
Do you have a barometer, not a barometer, a kind of decision when you're going to reintroduce, you're going to transition more from like peak to rate, or just introduce, you know, hops, some type of low level plyo?
Yeah, I think if they get the 5 out of 5 in the MMT and then they start showing me that they can do through a deficit. So I think that's a really important part is can they recreate that through a deficit? So it's more range of motion, it's more work, so it's a little bit harder than the MMT. If they can do body weight, you know, 8 to 10 reps, and they start showing me that they can add like a decent percentage of their body weight, anywhere from like 25 to 50%, then I'll start working on the hopping and kind of like more extensive kind of plyos, which is so like kind of like the longer contact time and they have an amplitude of force. A lot of times I just do pogo hops, pretty simple. Like I'll start band assisted and can they do double? And then can they do single? And then can they come off the band and do double and do single and kind of do it for time?
Okay. Yeah. I was going to ask. So let's say like now you're going to their first, like the banded double leg. What is the volume or like time description you're giving for that?
Yeah,
to start.
I know we've gone through this too, like you're 5 minutes. And that's you know, the whole quagmire of like how do you dose things and how do you load things. But I'll look for at least like 30 seconds being kind of like almost like a testing criteria. Like I like the 30-second single leg pogo hop as like a return to run kind of passing test. Like if you can't hop on one leg for 30 seconds, then we're probably not ready for like a return to running progression. And again, that seemed kind of backed up and with the expert opinion paper, they were talking about, you know, if you can't hop, then I don't know, you're probably not gonna be able to run. So yeah, working from like the 30 seconds for double leg band assisted, single leg band assisted, double leg no assist, single leg no assist. But I may start at like 10 seconds and doing 3 to 5 rounds to kind of train them for that ability. And then I'm a fan of skips, like A skips. Again, more extensive kind of plyometric where it's like longer contact time, not as big of an amplitude of force, and they can always grade it in. You know, their ability to explode off of the skip is dependent on them.
Does your thought process or progressions change if it was like an Achilles tendinopathy versus a soleus strain versus gastroc strain? Obviously, we discussed like gastroc may have more commonly a more acute presentation, may we need to respect more of like just these, you know, acute healing tissue times. But with just overall thoughts of where to progress, does that change from a tendon perspective compared to just a muscle strain perspective?
Yeah, I think with a tendon, you're going probably based on pure like irritability. So if they're not that irritable, I may have them hopping like immediately, but I may have them hopping like with band assist so that we're purely working on like their rate of force development while we're covering other gaps. Like if I think Like an easy example would be like if they have a keratinopathy and I test them isometric dynamometer and they have that, like, you know, so they have like 1.25 times body weight strength, then I go, okay, we're not going to like get there until the strength is better. So like your rate of force development isn't a problem yet because your strength is limiting you. So like your peak is this low. So your impulse is going to be always low. We don't have to solve the RFD problem until we get the peak force higher, but it doesn't mean that we just shelve anything that looks plyometric. But, you know, so if peak force is a problem, then we can take away body weight by adding the band assist, and you can still get like the training for like the quick muscle contraction that's going to be needed for when we return to whatever activity is. Unless they don't care about that kind of activity, if they're just an adult that has Achilles pain with like walking and like stairs and stuff, then we just may never get there. So whereas opposed to muscle strain, that might just come later because like you're thinking more about like a contractile muscle tolerance.
So again, what's the threshold? What peak are you looking for?
And shoot that. Ideally, 2 times body weight.
And then,
let's
say, like you said, they're at 1.2 or whatever. What a, like, if it's double leg, like jump rope or pogos, do they need 2 times to start that? Because it's like, no,
I don't think so. It just, it's whether or not, like, the juice worth the squeeze, you know, like, does it flare them up?
Yeah.
You know, is it productive? You know, what's the training goal for it? Because there's that nice paper too where they show you the Achilles loads, you know, with each kind of activity, like compared to walking, compared to, again, like jump rope, compared to like single leg kind of forward hops. They kind of rank it all. That's a good way of kind of visualizing it, because then you're just thinking of like intensity times volume. You know, what's going to be more, you know, the walking doesn't sound too bad unless it's like a 10-mile walk, then that might flare you up. Whereas like 10 seconds of jump rope is way below like that threshold.
For sure.
Yeah. And that's just, you're just talking Achilles load, which is a little different. But I didn't want to miss this big piece. I think we've kind of been talking around it, is that with the gastroc and soleus difference, like I don't treat the knee angles a lot differently. And I think, like, we talked about it too, like peak force being like the primary thing. So I think like if you're a clinician treating somebody with a calf strain, whether it's gastroc or soleus, I don't think you need to get too cute about trying to isolate one of them, because the soleus is always going to work no matter what the knee angle is. Obviously the gastroc is going to be slackened with knee flexion. So if you have someone with a gastroc strain, it's pretty easy. You just always do straight leg kind of stuff pretty much. But if you have someone with a soleus strain, like it's not like I'm doing only knee bent activity. I'm doing whatever they can handle from the highest load perspective. And oftentimes the way you can get the highest load on the calf is like a single leg deficit calf raise, and oftentimes it's pretty easy and comfortable to do it with a straight leg, because like the bent knee just makes it like a little weird. Like you can do it, but oftentimes like I just find people are like kind of cheating a lot, and like the knee angle's changing and they're kind of shifting like anterior to posterior, and I think it's like a simpler thing to just teach them like the straight leg single leg deficit calf raise, and then you can just add load however you can, like weight vest, holding a dumbbell, having the SSB on your back, Smith machine, at least some way they can have balance and add load. And I don't think it takes a lot. Like even if you don't have a barbell, I think you could like throw on a weight vest and hold a 50-pound dumbbell in one hand, and you should be cracking some pretty high intensity with that. Like you're probably over most people's like, or close to like 50% body weight, which I think is like pretty challenging.
Yeah,
go ahead, Mason. I was gonna say, I'm glad you said that, Mike, because I was doing this in evals previously, And not so much as of recent, I've been doing this thing where it's like, okay, we do straight leg, you know, MMT. And then it's like, you're trying to coach this bent knee in the same way. And so I had people like leaning backwards, like holding on to something. And they're just like, am I doing this right? I'm like, I don't really know if you are, but they're like, yeah, this kind of feels the same. And I'm just like, damn, is it worth teasing out the two? So I'm glad that you've kind of had that experience. To your point, though, saying that you're probably getting what you need from just testing straight leg MMT.
Yeah, I think external load and like force reduction is going to trump any kind of like position thing. So like if you're trying to get really cute with like bent knee soleus stuff, like even barbell seated soleus calf raises, I think are way too underloaded. Like you could throw 315 on the bar and roll it onto both legs, and that's probably only two times body weight, and you're distributing it over two legs. So now you're just doing one times body weight soleus.
And it's like a three-man job.
Yeah, it's a three-man job, and like it's fine, but it's probably not much harder than doing a single leg deficit calf raise. Like, so it's like, like when you do you work out the mat. So it's like, just do the single leg deficit calf raise because you could do it anywhere. You can just need a stair, you know, like essentially.
Well, y'all, when I was there, there's quite a bit of that. Have you pulled away from it?
Gone. Yeah, it's gone.
Trash.
Gone. Yeah, it's trash. And like, unless you're doing a Smith machine and you can do it single leg, right? Like maybe then we're talking, but then you just probably just need one of those calf raise machines, you know, the seated ones. Like those I like. If we had one of those in the clinic, I would use it because you can probably overload it like a lot more and a lot more easily.
Yeah, it seems like, well, I see it at our clinic and it seems to be the norm is like, kind of like Mason, the setup you explained, you're like holding onto a squat rack, you're in squatting position, but then the quad just easily becomes the limiter, and then people just raise up the hips and you're like, what the fuck is this? Or you're sitting and you have a heavy kettlebell on your leg, and neither of those are really truly changing anything.
Yeah,
it's just not enough.
Like my biggest pet peeve, and I think we talked about this going into the show, is like if you're doing it for a like strength adaptation, like you should just not be doing like a dumbbell or a kettlebell on your knee, like calf raise, unless they are that weak.
Yeah.
Which might happen from like a post-op perspective, might happen from like an untrained person perspective, where that's actually challenging. Like I have someone right now who's coming off of an Achilles tendon rupture, and he's doing 80-pound single leg deficit, you know, calf raises. And I'm trying to rep him out. I'm saying like, try to hit 20, you know, and he's at 13 right now. And like, as soon as we can hit 20, I'm just going to like pull it, because we're also doing standing single leg deficit calf raises for like 5 to 8 reps. And that's what's like challenging for him. So we're doing like kind of like strength work, and we're doing like endurance work. And at least I know the RPEs are high, but if someone's just like has their foot in the ground and they got like a 25-pound dumbbell on their knee, and they're like, I'm doing this because I'm a runner, like taking one running step is like way more like total load than a whole session of what you're doing on with the dumbbell.
Yeah, I have a post-op fibular fracture, and we're just doing seated body weight calf raises because that's all she can tolerate.
I mean, it could be good for range of motion too. Like you can get people into like a deep dorsiflexion stretch, which is like another thing that authors talk about. They don't like really aggressively range people after a calf strain. They're just like, it'll come back when it comes back. Like you don't need to be doing like runner stretches and stuff, and because the rehab is going to put you through full range of motion when you can tolerate it. So
I have a question. So you had mentioned the Achilles, this guy's post-op Achilles rupture repair.
Yeah, he's about 6 months out now.
So there's a guy at our clinic, he's on the chiro side. He is non-op Achilles rupture rehab, and they've at this point, well, one, have you treated an athlete that's non-op?
Yeah.
Is what are your I haven't seen one, but I've just like kind of from a periphery seen their progressions of where they're going with it. And now I'm seeing them work on a ton of rate based things, like some higher velocity, like sled work and some like step ups. I'm like, okay, well, are we ever going to get to a higher peak, or do we just start working on what has your experience been when they're non-op and their calf is tiny?
Honestly, I mean, it was a while ago, actually. It was maybe like 6-7 years ago, and I was done. So I don't know. I just know that he like completed the rehab, you know, end quotes. But if I'm just using like an overall example, I guess, of like, yeah, like you're saying, like their peak strength still low, the muscle size still low. When do you start working on other things?
Yeah, because I don't know anything, but I've just seen them train him, and like his whole calf is like half the size of his non-involved limb. And will that stay that way with that type of non-surgical? Or is it because they're just severely underloading him, or a combination?
Or a combination. I mean, it's like, you know, at some point, right, you can't like undo the past. So like having that is probably going to put you behind the eight ball a little bit from like that calf performance perspective. You know, like not everyone returns 100%. Like we know that from ACL reconstruction research. So it'd be unfair to be like, yeah, like he absolutely needs to have like symmetrical calf girth and like peak strength. But then it's like, what are you deciding is good enough, I guess? And that's always like a hard thing, I guess. Yeah. Like we have probably the most research with like, again, like hamstring strains and like ACL reconstruction, but you know, is 80% good enough? Is 90% good enough? And then when you start like incorporating the other things, because like they're humans and they're gonna be bored if you're just like, I need you to do single leg deficit calf raises for like 12 months. You know, like, and that's it, like just walk, you know, like we have these issues with our, you know, our ACL patients, because this is like they want to do something that probably looks like the task that they're trying to get back to, or the activity they're trying to get back to, and you do have to scale it up. So I think there is value in doing stuff before they're like there, you know, but again, like kind of emphasizing what's important. And then how do you dose that higher rate or higher power activity so that it doesn't interfere with it's somewhat productive? I don't know. That could be good too. It could, you know, continue the process. Like a totally different scenario. I have somebody else in who is post tib fracture, and you know, the surgeon's kind of hemming and hawing because it's like, we're 5 months out and the CT scan shows that it's still not like 100% healed, but they're like, I'm going to clear you for return to plyometrics because like it seems stable. And the parents are worried because of like, are we being too conservative? Are we being too aggressive? And I'm like, well, honestly, I think we know that like plyometrics and kind of power-based activity is good for bone formation. So it's like, his strength is there, so why not just take the next step? Because maybe that's the adaptation that we need. Like, we'll never get there until we do it. So maybe there is some value in like starting some of the stuff earlier, because it kind of gives you that other adaptation. Because like you may plateau with just doing like the basic like 6 to 8 reps of strengthening. Maybe you need that other stimulus to kind of like invigorate the area.
I feel like I have seen that in a few Achilles repairs where it's like they're just kind of capped out on calf strength. And it's like, to your point, I could say, all right, next 3 months, let's just ride with some calf. Like, you're just doing the same shit. And then I'm like, okay, well, if I had potentially give them some rate things, like, is that going to maybe get us over the hump a little bit? I don't know. I'm just kind of played around with it, because I'm like, the calf stuff they're super bored with, I'm super bored with, and it's like, okay, let's just try it.
Yeah. And in the tendinopathy research, it shows that they have deficits across the board. Like, they have deficits in endurance, strength, rate, you know, like it's not just one thing. So again, like, and I'm kind of flipping between research, but the expert opinion on the cap strain was like, we're going to do everything because they have to do everything. You know, they have to be able to slow jog, sprint, jump, get into a scrum, you know, like they got to cover 12 kilometers in a rugby match. Like you kind of can't leave any stone unturned, which is hard from a rehab perspective to be able to like address every need, but you have to kind of be thinking like that.
Mason, do you have any other strain-related questions? If not, I think more of the other differentials would be a good place to go next.
Nah.
Okay. Let's chat about front of the leg. Maybe you chat about like differential with shin splint, medial tibial stress syndrome versus exertional compartment syndrome versus anterior tib, like tendinopathy or presentation. What goes through your head with some of these like front of the shin, medial lateral parts of the shin?
Yeah, that stuff gets tricky, right? There's a lot of structures, and I think it's easy to just kind of lump everything into like shin splints. And I think like population matters a lot. So I think we often think of like runners as having these problems. And I think with runners, you have to think about like age and gender and what else that brings along with it. So I think some of these issues you have to be kind of conservative on in a way to make sure that bony stuff isn't going on, like bony stress injuries. I'm not an expert in that, so you should have somebody else on the podcast for BSI stuff, but unless you already have. But I think like you need to have that on the radar first. Before you're like, you know, you should be trying to rule that out. Kind of like when people come in for low back pain, you're trying to rule out all the red flag stuff. I think when you start thinking about these other kind of like near the bone issues, like that should be on your radar always. Because then you have to like kind of rule that out, or at least like reduce the probability of it before you're proceeding into like the next differential category. I don't know if you wanted to add to that.
Yeah, the only, when I was looking at some medial tibial stress stuff, they were like, how is this differentiated like to a stress fracture? And it seems like the focalness of a stress fracture is one of the key determinants. I forgot some of the others, but this tibial stress syndrome seems more diffuse. And it has to be, I think, like a certain like 5 centimeters or 2, I forgot what the width was, but a long enough span. And then I don't know about, have you seen like a chronic exertional compartment syndrome and how that presents?
Yeah, I'm seeing someone right now actually for it, and they feel it mostly in their calves. So their complaints are their calves feel tight and that it increases with activity. So we're doing a lot of strength and endurance work with the calves and the anterior tib actually, just to kind of, you know, do like a quote unquote push pull and ramping up walking and seeing if walking feels comfortable before we try to do any return to running. And we're doing like band assisted plyometrics that try to mimic some of the running force. She's not like a huge runner, but she wants to do it. So
did they come in with that diagnosis? Like
my coworker, Peter, they saw my coworker first. So I took them from him, and
nice.
And they seem to have kind of come upon that agreement themselves because they thought it was like a calf strain at first, but it was like, just didn't respond. There was no like mechanism, and it really is like dependent on kind of like volume of activity. But that can be tricky. And I think, again, I've kind of done some research into it because I had someone for upper body recently. That was a little strange, but you know, you really need that like testing to confirm it. You know, the exertional exercise testing, and then need to like, you know, needle the compartments and remeasure the pressure. So it's hard. I think it's hard to diagnose like in the clinic. It can definitely be something you like clinically like it's like a high hypothesis, but to like formally diagnose it, I think it's hard because you have to like usually refer them to some kind of specialist. And then, yeah. And so then there's that, right? And then there's, I think, all the tendon issues that can be, that can arise. So you have your mediotibial stress syndrome, but then you can have like, you know, posterior tib tendinopathy. You can have peroneal tendinopathy, maybe anterior tib tendinopathy. I haven't seen many of that, but a lot of these things kind of, obviously the muscle structures and where they're located are different, but you know, symptoms can be diffuse and the activity that provokes the pain can be similar for all these kind of things, which is often, again, mostly like the running based things.
In the same vein as like the soleus strain versus like isolating gastroc or soleus, do you find it's not worth getting super cutesy if it's like a posterior tib issue, or will you try to find some things to like bias, okay, I'm loading posterior tib a little more potentially?
I might, and then that, you know, that's when I can just use more open chain stuff too. And I'll do isometric dynamometer testing for ankle eversion and inversion. It's kind of easy because you can just do like a break test, so you can have them like side lying and just kind of just push down on the foot. So you can get an idea of like one, like load tolerance, like does it hurt? Does it recreate their symptom? And two, is there some kind of asymmetry? I don't have any good data on like norms, but that's when I go for more like an LSI. And I'm not afraid to then do open chain strengthening if I think inversion or eversion is limited. But from like a weight bearing standpoint, I may not change a lot. Like I may cue the inversion at the top of a calf raise, but that's more just like a PT school trick. Like I don't have any like, or like, you know, the classic kind of ball squeeze.
No, I'm just asking if you have the wizard posterior tib exercise that
just like, you know, good old banded inversion. I think it's not a bad idea a lot of times.
Story time. I have this girl who she got like bilateral medial knee pain, bilateral chronic like recurrent ankle sprains and ankle instability, and then what I am unsure is potentially a lift big toe like stress fracture or just like a turf toe versus like a sesamoiditis. I'm not sure. I'm trying to figure out at that point. But anyways, she's, because of the turf toe and unable to really like tolerate plantar flexion at the moment, I've been doing like a bunch of manual resisted just ankle positions, eversion, inversion. She goes, do you not feel weird like touching people's feet? Like, you go through a clinical rotation in a hospital setting, everything in outpatient ortho is such a breeze with like the measure of grossness. There's nothing that could come into the clinic that would throw me off guard.
I'm trying to think about that. No, probably not. But that reminds me though, I do like resisted, like manually resisted ankle inversion, eversion, especially because you can like force the eccentric.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can we go down the path of like weird below the knee presentations you've seen? I mean, before we got on, we chatted about that one kid that I had an eval with when you were there with like tibial rotation. And then I had a kid a week or two ago that was diagnosed, their pediatrician referred them over for being a toe walker. And I mean, maybe I can start with that story while you think if there's any others, but I briefly looked up like the natural history of toe walking and whether or not it resolves on its own. And if, you know, ruling out any other concerning neurological type of disorders that are potentially associated with it. But if it's idiopathic, there's like, I think I looked up, it's a third or a fourth of the adolescent or pediatric population is a toe walker. And then like 80% of those will self-resolve by like age 10 or age 8. And the kid was like right on that cusp. And he came in, he had no pain. Literally the pediatrician was like, just coming over thinking that potentially PT can help. And the mom is just like, I just want to make sure it's not something concerning for future. He could obviously walk on his toes. He could walk on his heels. He could run, jump, skip, was asymptomatic, had full range motion. And I like kind of gave these baseline stats. It may self-resolve. There's a high chance. And if it doesn't, it's not correlated with like increased pain being a toe walker. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things where it's like kind of these weird niche presentations that may come in that you probably should know, like, when should I refer back out if there's something concerning? So anyways, yeah. Do you have any stories like that?
No, I think pediatrics is definitely an area where I will like 9 times out of 10 refer out.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think if it's not like musculoskeletal, I don't think it's like a muscle or like range of motion issue. Like I feel more comfortable like doing a screen and then like referring out. At least like in Boston, that's pretty easy most of the time because there's like a couple of major hospitals in the area that specialize in that. But like I had someone recently who was like 8 or 9, and she twisted her ankle falling off of a monkey bar, and she got placed in the boot. And then once the boot came off, she could not put her foot on the floor. And she has a sensory processing disorder as part of her medical history. So she essentially came in with like a CRPS diagnosis where she had like hypersensitivity to touch, and she would not weight bear at all, not even partially, not even like seated. She wouldn't put her foot on the floor unless she had a like flex tape figure eight on her foot, and then she could put a sock on and then she could like weight bear and do everything, like play soccer, run around, the whole 9 yards. Once the flex tape came off, like you couldn't, you know, it was like very, very classic, like sensitive to cotton ball, light touch. And, you know, I had like a very clear kind of start and stop to where it was hypersensitive. So we tried some desensitization techniques. And then I essentially told her, like, she had a follow-up coming up with like a lower extremity specialist team at Boston Children's. And I was like, you know, when that appointment comes, like that's going to be where you're probably going to continue care after this, because I'll just kind of get the ball rolling. But if it changes before then, cool. If it doesn't change before then, like I would transition her care to them, which she did. So that, you know, that was definitely like out of my scope. I was like, yeah, I can't. So if stuff like that happens, I just try to refer out, because that's way, way beyond like what I do on like a day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of what else I've seen that's kind of odd. I've seen like anterior tib rhabdo turn into like necrosis, where then they lost like dorsiflexion. So essentially had like a drop foot. It's like a young guy, like 22, 23, went through like a police academy training. So he went to police academy. And they had him sprint from the car to the front door, back to the car. I don't know, some weird stuff in like his dress shoes. And they like made him do that a bunch of times and made him run a bunch of miles that day. And then that was it. He got rhabdo and he got misdiagnosed. It got missed. And they ended up developing, you know, necrosis of the anterior tib, and had to get an AFO, and we tried to work on like e-stim stuff, never came back. And then he ended up getting a posterior tib tendon transfer to try to bring it back, and that failed. And yeah, it was like a 2-year mess. That one was tough. And then, yeah.
Wow. You think that's probably been...
Don't do that.
Was that probably your toughest? I mean, there's the CRPS and that one both sound like, especially that one, but yeah, is that probably the up there for?
Yeah. That's mostly feel bad too. Like I remember the guy with the anterior tib necrosis, like he was like one of my first evaluations when I started my job here at Boston PT Wellness. But he's also the only person to have benched 315 in the clinic because we were just doing that to make him happy. But yeah, I think, again, it's kind of knowing your role, knowing what you can provide. So I think pediatric stuff tends to be a little fuzzy in outpatient. If it's like, you know, is it neurological and developmental versus like musculoskeletal? And there's a lot of, you know, a lot of gray area and it's tough. You know, we have someone in right now with a fibular fracture and she's like 9 weeks out and my student's seeing her and it's slow. You know, like the girl's having a hard time just like plantar flexing and weight bearing. And I just think we're having to, you know, just trust the timeline. We'll get her there. But it's like going slower than we would imagine. And I think that's just like comes with the territory sometimes with kids. Mm. Like they're, you know, they're not a fully functioning adult. So it's hard to like predict a lot of times the prognosis. Even if it's like purely musculoskeletal.
So on the opposite end of the spectrum, geriatric or older adult, you want to chat about the importance of calves and all that?
Yeah, I think that's like the home run there for us. I think you can do like a self, you know, in clinic study and screen like every older adult's like plantar flexion MMT. And I like guarantee they're like, it's going to be less than 3 out of 5 in like a majority of people. I'm just speaking anecdotally. I wish it was the opposite was true, but I think we have research by Stenroth. They do a lot of the research in like plantar flexion strength in older adults and seems to be more predictive of like fall risk and functional mobility than like quad strength. And quad RFD. And again, that could be like the way the study is like designed and so on and so forth. But not to say like quads aren't important and like set the standability and all the kind of stuff that we test in older adults. But I think, again, the lower quarter of the lower quarter might be getting like kind of glanced over in our older adult community, because end of the day, it's like, you know, it's the first kind of interaction with the ground. Right, so your ability to kind of like put force into the ground and push, and whether it's like community ambulation, stairs, walking, I think it's like it's really important. And it just seems that anecdotally, it just seems like there's a lot of room for improvement. I think like doing one single leg calf raise through a full range of motion is hard to come by. Mm. In a lot of our patients who are over 65, it's rare that I see that on the bowel. And who knows what, you know, in comorbidities, you know, whether they've had any kind of neurological deficit from whatever diagnosis they have, whether it's like previous stroke, Parkinson's, MS, like these things are common. It's not like, you know, it's not like people aren't going to walk into your clinic with those comorbidities, whether it's like their primary reason for treatment or it's like something that's part of their medical history. But I just think we have some research to show it's important. And then I think anecdotally, I just think a lot of older adults, you know, globally obviously have strength and sarcopenia issues, but I think calves are largely not talked about a lot.
Yeah. It's also, you ever just look at an old person's calves when they're doing a calf raise and just like, the calf itself, you're like, this thing has had a life. Just the amount of interesting veins and like the shape of the calf. I think about that a lot when I look at some of my older adults' calves. I don't know if you just think about that.
It's done some things. It's definitely done something. yeah, and I wonder, like, you know, it's not like everyone needs to go to the gym from like age 12 to like 80 and do calf raises, but I wonder like what kind of activities can, you know, maintain function. You know, like, is hiking good enough?
Yeah.
You know, is walking good enough? Like, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But you know, we have the like older adult strength training class here that Melanie teaches, and we make them all do calf raises. Because then also like jumping is going to be hard if you don't have good calf strength. Like we've already talked about that from an athletic standpoint. So trying to make somebody who's, you know, not primarily like a 20-year-old athlete jump, you know, obviously there's a lot of muscles involved for that. But if you don't have full calf strength and you want them to jump to get bone health improvement, it might be hard with a very weak calf to kind of get that ability.
And all the older adults in that class are jumping?
A lot of them are. Yeah, I think we try to make a rule of, like, you know, improving the calf strength and kind of squat strength first. But eventually they all kind of get there, with whether it's like, you know, the first kind of avenue is usually the band assisted pogo hops. So it, you know, it may not look exactly like, you know, like a really clean jump rope kind of looking thing, but it's still something, right? And if their knees need to bend a lot to help them, like, okay, that's fine. But something's happening, kind of going back to our other conversation about, like, starting them before they're completely ready is not like the worst thing in the world.
What other lower quarter, the lower quarter, Mason, you got any specific cases in mind or any presentations that you're working with right now?
Nope. A lot of Achilles repairs, and I've seen one calf strain, but it's just primarily Achilles repairs and then like stuff we've already talked about.
I have the lady who's the fib fracture, had an eval with her last week, got no protocol. So I just pulled up, I think it's Ohio State's protocol. Do you all in Boston have most surgeons, if it's a tib fib or just a fib fracture, will they send you things, or are you just going based off of what do you?
I've had a lot of tib fib fractures over the last year. I would say we don't get a lot of guidance besides, like, you know, weight bearing status.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then obviously the kid I was talking about recently, who's like, he's trying to return to basketball, and they've been like kind of holding him back from plyometrics because of the bone healing. Otherwise, no, I don't get a lot of protocols for those. It's kind of just progressive, tolerated, and there's some instruction about weight bearing typically.
Yeah. Got it.
Yeah. Which again, like, I think tib fib fractures are tough.
Totally.
I think it's a really challenging rehab process. I think they have a lot of range of motion limitations, a lot of strength limitations, like poor single leg balance for a while, poor tolerance to weight bearing, you know, like kind of weaning off of that, like crutches, boot to the full weight bearing journey is hard. Some people have issues with like hardware. I had someone had to get their hardware removed because the peroneal tendon was just like getting really irritated. And like, none of our interventions were making that better. You know, just continue to have peroneal like tendinopathy. And they went in and took out the plate essentially. And like, yeah, there was like a bunch of scar tissue and they had to debride some of the area. And like, it was just like, I guess, bad placement or unlucky placement of the plate. And it was just like the peroneal tendon was like just rubbing on it. But yeah, it can be a challenging rehab process.
One of my coworkers, he saw a guy less than 24 hours post discharge from the hospital, tib fib fracture, high schooler. He was doing a football game. He got someone's helmet just straight into his leg.
Wow.
And I was like, poor guy's coming out. It's like big dude, 6'2", 6'3", and multiple D1 offers. And now the concern is like, you're in your senior year. How long is this going to take? Are you just going to immediately get dropped from all these offers because of this really pretty traumatic injury?
Stuff. Yeah, I think, you know, the classic, like, oh, it's better to break your ankle than sprain your ankle is like, I don't know. That's a silly.
I don't even know what the timelines are. Like, maybe it's because I haven't seen any, but like, there's a rough heuristic for ACL return to sport if you meet these objective criteria. For tib fib stuff, do you have any like rough heuristics of return to high school or collegiate? No.
No. I mean, the kid I have right now is trying to return to basketball. It was definitely more on the minor side. Like, it wasn't a dislocation. Like, it wasn't like that disrupted. So, you know, I think he's going to be ready to return to sport at like kind of like that 6 month mark. But he's also like maybe a little bit of a unicorn. Like, his calf strength is like ridiculous. So, We got him doing single leg calf raises with like 130 pounds on his back, you know, and he's like, Jesus. He's a kid. He's not like huge, but he's like, you know, he's built. So, but yeah, I just think those things can be tough. I think having those expectation kind of conversations with patients is hard too. You know, it's like a really long journey.
Yeah.
You know, I have someone just now who's like completed, like he's like one day ago was my one year anniversary of like my fracture. This is the guy that had the hardware removal. So it's just been like, you know, been a long journey. Like he can do mostly everything. He's just not doing anything sport like. Not that he really wants to. It's just kind of like a dad who like has kids that play soccer, but he would want to be able to kind of like, you know, kick around the ball and run around and not feel limited. But you know, we're like just getting there, and it's like a full year later. But there's a lot of steps in that journey. And again, like, yeah, you said like ACL gets a lot of attention, but I think a lot of these injuries have like similar problems and similar journeys.
Any other thoughts, either of y'all? It's maybe a good stopping point. Really span the whole old, young.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Lower quarter of the lower quarter.
Lower quarter of the lower quarter.
Yeah. I don't do plantar aspect of the feet. That's where I draw a line. I draw the line right below, like right after the heel. Like, but not the plantar heel. Is that
the lower quarter of the lower quarter of the lower quarter? LQ, what is it? Cubed.
Yeah.
No, I honestly I think the biggest thing would just be like, I don't think it's that hard. It's not like any stigma attached to doing like calf raises. It's not like we're trying to like, I feel like with back pain, it's like, you know, there's a hard sell on doing like back extensions and deadlifts for back pain, right? And like it might be a hard sell on like knee pain for like squats and like knee extensions. I don't think we have any hard sell on calf. Like I think that's easy. I just think like people just don't know. So I just think like just do, when in doubt, a single leg deficit calf raise it out. I don't get like, I just don't think there's a problem. I don't think there's any obstacle besides just maybe it flying under our radar. Whether it's like, again, like getting referrals for calf strains, but even then, like that stuff is useful for Achilles tendinopathy, Achilles rupture repair, obviously, and older adult function. I think it's like across the board there. Not that you can cure the world's ailments with like one exercise. I just think it's like pretty low stakes, pretty low hanging fruit, pretty minimal equipment is needed.
Boom. I think that's a good stopping point. When in doubt, calf raise it out. That was the motto with a motto during my rotation. When in doubt.
The motto, yeah. You know, and it's easy to teach. You do this at home. You know, if you don't think it's like that skilled and not necessary for their rehab process, then you can at least have them do it, you know, at home if it's not like a primary impairment.
Yeah. Boom. All right, Mason, any other final thoughts?
No, thanks for coming on again, Mike. Are you the first? Oh, wait, are you the no?
No, I had two or three repeat. Two. Yeah. I do want to, I wanted to say after that clinical with you, consistently I've been training calves and I have these weird two goals. Not even, well, actually I have one goal. I've been training adductors and calves very like, what's the word, religiously. And I have maxed out the seated adductor machine, but I want to get a 10 RM on the bottom, the heaviest weight, and then seated calf raise. I don't know if I have a goal, but it's just, I wanted to let you know that now it's been a year plus of crushing calves.
A lot could change in a year. I think I did the same kind of switch around, like maybe a little bit before that. I just started focusing on single leg deficit calf raises. I was like doing like K-box seated stuff and all this like kind of fancy looking thing, like the seated barbell. And my Achilles was feeling worse. And I was like, all right, I'm scrapping all this stuff. And I'm just going to get down to like, you know, brass tacks, right? And now my maintenance is like 50% body weight, single leg deficit calf raises for like 5 reps. And I'm like, I'm just like maintaining that right now until my half marathon. Then after my half marathon in the winter, we're getting aggressive again. lots of hill sprints, lots of calf raises, lots of hamstring Nordics.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
All right. We'll call it there. Thanks again, Mike.
Thank you.
Yeah.